Welcome to The Thing About Austen, a podcast about Jane Austen's world. I'm Zan.
And I'm Diane. And this episode, we're talking about Henry Crawford reading Shakespeare. This episode takes us to Mansfield Park. We are in the latter half of the novel. Fanny has had her ball, and Henry Crawford has proposed. Fanny has declined, but Crawford continues to press his suit with the support of the majority of the Mansfield crowd. Definitely not the support of Mrs. Norris, who is livid that anyone would even look at Fanny. Crawford joins them for dinner after Edmund's return home, and that evening he picks up a volume of Shakespeare recently set aside by Fanny. He starts to read aloud. And, as it turns out, Henry is very, very good at reading aloud.
This is true. This is what we get from the text. She seemed determined to be interested by nothing else. But taste was too strong in her. She could not abstract her mind 5 minutes. She was forced to listen. His reading was capital, and her pleasure in good reading, extreme. To good reading, however, she had been long used. Her uncle read well, her cousins all, Edmund very well. But in Mr. Crawford's reading, there was a variety of excellence beyond what she had ever met with. The king, the queen, Buckingham, Wolsey, Cromwell, all were given in turn. For with the happiest knack, the happiest power of jumping and guessing, he could always alight, at will, at the best scene or the best speeches of each. And whether it were dignity or pride or tenderness or remorse or whatever were to be expressed, he could do it with equal beauty. It was truly dramatic.
Wow.
Ow,
she's just like, wow. Yeah, she's having a very, very intense moment here.
I mean, again, the fact that she has to acknowledge to herself, I mean, Edmund reads very well, but he's better at this.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So the play that Henry reads from is Shakespeare's Henry VIII, which is one of his historical plays and depicts King Henry's controversial divorce from Catherine and his subsequent marriage to Anne Boleyn. It also highlights the political machinations of Cardinal Wolsey and Cromwell, the eventual founding of the Church of England, and the birth of Queen Elizabeth I. So that's the text being referenced, which is not without its own significance.
Yes. We definitely want to be focusing most of our episode on the act of reading aloud and how that's being used as an interaction between Crawford and Fanny, because there's actually quite a lot of cultural context going on behind the scene here. But before we do that, we do have to acknowledge the rather direct connection between Austen's Shakespearean allusion and the character of Henry Crawford.
We have Henry Crawford, perhaps not exactly known for his fidelity, reading aloud from a play about a king who changed wives as often as he changed his shirts. So the connection is practically screaming to be pointed out. And Park Honan, in his book, Jane Austen, Her Life, argues that, quote, "The king's modern living namesake and civilized representative, Henry Crawford, brings Henry VIII into the present in an important way. I once saw Henry VIII acted," says Henry Crawford modestly and amiably to Edmund, who agrees that we all talk Shakespeare, use his similes, and describe with his descriptions, but maintains that Henry has performed a singular feat in giving the playwright's exact sense at Mansfield. This comment is double-edged. Henry Crawford is at once a callous misuser of women, as Henry VIII more brutally was, and also a cultivated and talented man whose feelings for the stage is needed. So basically, Henry Crawford is a cad, but also the man really can read Shakespeare.
I love that it's just like, it's not even subtle, the fact that Austen would have him reading Henry VIII. Like, it's not, she's not pulling punches here. pretty direct, yeah. So shortly after the passage we just read, Austen writes, quote, "The subject of reading aloud was farther discussed. And then Edmund and Crawford go on to talk about how the skill of reading aloud is so important. Edmund even says, quote, "How little the art of reading has been studied. How little a clear manner and good delivery have been attended to." Like, he's got feelings about this. Like, reading aloud needs to be done well for Edmund.
To modern readers, this might initially seem like a weird subject of conversation, and yet Crawford and Edmund really get into it. Readers in Austen's time, however, would have recognized that this conversation was actually part of the larger cultural debates around the elocution movement of the late 18th century.
According to Adela Pinch's article, Hearing Voices in Austen, The Representation of Speech and Voice in the Novels, quote, "The terms of Edmund's and Henry's discussion of reading aloud come right from the elocutionists' manuals. They canvass the need for early attention and habit to instill the skills of reading, of management of the voice, of proper modulation and emphasis, of foresight and judgment, of the need for distinctness and energy in reading." Thus, Austen makes clear how familiar she expects her readers to be with this discourse. All of this kind of this discourse about the elocution movement, this is where we're really going to dive in today.
In the 17th century and well into the 18th, the word read was nearly synonymous with read aloud. According to Elsbeth Judge Delska's article, Reading Instruction and Social Identity in Elite 18th Century Learners, reading was essentially under the umbrella of spoken rhetoric and even performance.
But there was a big shift in the way that people were reading aloud between the 17th and 18th century. Judge Delska explains that 17th century oral reading was usually loud, slow, heavily rhythmic, and sort of like a sing-song or chant style, kind of like you'd expect from a really heavily memorized text performed for a large audience, just really, really rhythmic.
But in the mid-18th century, this theatrical style of oral reading was considered passé, and the new preference was for what elocutionists considered a conversational style. You know, we're just like in the moment here. Judge Delska considers that one of the potential reasons for the shift was because reading, even oral reading, was becoming more of a private thing. More people are able to read, and specifically the affluent people are now reading in their drawing rooms or with families in smaller gatherings that don't really require a big formal oratory style.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, the scene in Austen is a very apt description of this, right? They're just in a living room or a drawing room together. So you don't need to really belt this out, you know?
You don't need to project to the rafters anymore.
Exactly, exactly. So Roberta Malini's article, Reading Aloud in Britain in the Second Half of the 18th Century, also reinforces this idea. She writes, 18th century British society lived through an era of vast improvement of literacy, especially in the middle class, and of female literacy, so that the century's great novels were certainly written not only for silent reading, but with an ear to family and shared readings.
But this can't just be as simple as reading out loud in a conversational style. Oh no. This has to be a skill that is cultivated. And there's a whole philosophy and movement that are tied to the ability to read aloud with real skill.
So the two biggest names in the 18th century elocution movement were Thomas Sheridan, who was father of the playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who you've probably heard us reference before, and the other being John Walker. Both men had a background in the theater and then became lecturers on the idea of elocution. So, for example, Sheridan started as a stage manager, but then moved on to reinvent himself as a lecturer and teacher who would help students learn how to speak better English. And we're, you know, air quotes on the better here, better English. So this is some real Henry Higgins energy for the Pygmalion My Fair Lady crowd.
According to Daniel John DeWispelaer's article, Spectacular Speech, Performing Language in the Late 18th Century, Sheridan believed that, quote, bad elocution revealed one's relative poverty, marginalization, and lack of inheritance, whether real, i.e. property, or abstract, i.e. cultural. As a solution, he offered proper elocutionary training to those who wished convincingly to counterfeit their linguistic backgrounds so as to make themselves appear courtly, worthy, and refined. Again, the worthy is just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're rolling our eyes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Because we do need to acknowledge that this concept of elocution has some deep and problematic colonial roots, since it was meant to standardize speech in a way that homogenized and flattened cultures. Sheridan really pushed for this in his own country of Ireland, where England was making a formalized effort to stamp out the Irish language. And Sheridan thought that similarly eradicating the Irish accent would be a way for English-speaking Irish citizens to matriculate into English society. And that's just one instance. So you can see how this kind of similar linguistic project would roll out in all sorts of seriously problematic ways beyond Europe and into places including, but not limited, to India, Australia, and the Caribbean. And unfortunately, many of these colonial ideas that there is a right way, heavy air quotes, to speak English, which is at least part of this elocution movement, a lot of those ideas are still prevalent today.
We can get a sense of just how problematic this was when we consider that elocution became a way of judging who were the right kind of people. Again, heavy air quotes around mm-hmm. these words like right. Judge Delska writes, "In the 18th century, however, oral reading appeared to be a matter of having the right kind of instruction and being the right kind of person. This implies that failure to read in the right way was the fault of poor instruction and poor taste." We don't like any of this. This
No.
is all very bad.
Right. Yeah. We're pointing it out because we know it's not okay. So perhaps not surprisingly, considering the level of social stratification at this time, elocution unfortunately became a really popular industry, even though there are all these problems that we're acknowledging here. Lots of people would attend elocution lectures, like the ones put on by Sheridan at the Drury Lane Theater. Richard Sheridan was the stage manager there and let his dad use the facility on an off night. And people would also attend elocution performances, and more people started to advertise for elocution lessons. There were even elocutionary miscellanies, which were collections of extracts of poetry and prose designed for reading out loud and a way to practice one's elocutionary skills.
The clergy were also really encouraged to work on their elocution, which Austin acknowledges in Mansfield Park. For example, Edmund says, "There is now a spirit of improvement abroad, but among those who were ordained 20, 30, 40 years ago, the larger number, to judge by their performance, must have thought reading was reading and preaching was preaching. It is different now. The subject is more justly considered." So reading and preaching are almost synonymous in the way he's describing this.
Yeah, it's very important to him that those two become kind of melded together. Yeah. And Crawford also points out that when he's listening to a sermon that, quote, "I must confess, being not always so attentive as I ought to be," here was a glance at Fanny, "that 19 times out of 20, I am thinking how such a prayer ought to be read and longing to have it to read myself." So yeah, during the sermons, he's thinking like, that should be read differently. Yeah.
He's not just thinking that should be read differently. He's thinking, I could do better. That's what
exactly,
he's thinking.
That is exactly what he's thinking. It's like, let me have that prayer book. Excuse me.
Let me show you how it's done. So there is something in these passages between Edmund and Crawford that implies that there is an element of ethical practice attached to proper elocution. And this was also implied in some of the elocution practices of the day.
So according to Dana Harrington's article, Remembering the Body, 18th Century Elocution and the Oral Tradition, some of these elocution lessons put a really heavy emphasis on oral reading with physical movements and gestures. So Harrington writes, "The embodied aspects of elocutionary practices are essential to understanding how elocutionists viewed their work as a part of practical ethics, as a means not only to educate students in the arts of oratory, but also to inculcate virtues associated with emergent concepts of 18th century civic culture." I mean, there's a lot going on there, right?
So the thought process was something like, I will read moral and ethical literature, and by physically embodying that ethical literature through voice and movement, I will then be more likely to actually emulate those moral qualities in my daily life. So if I'm a good reader, I'm probably a good person.
And, you know, logical fallacies aside, There is something kind of delightful about thinking of Crawford and Edmund prosing on about this, while we also know that Crawford is way more interested in the performance of reading than any ethical concerns, right? He's not wanting to read the prayer to get more spiritual. He wants to read the prayer because he thinks he can do it better. And at the same time, Edmund is mostly worried about like, oh, you know, I've got to do this well because I need to sound good in front of my congregation. Like both men are kind of...
It's kind of self-centered, yeah.
It's a little bit, look at me doing this so well kind of thing.
And yet, according to Pinch, quote, while Austin pokes gentle fun at both Henry and Edmund throughout their reading aloud discussion, the evidence of her concern with the reading aloud of her own fiction suggests that the concerns of the elocutionist, the vision of print as matter to be converted into sound, alluded to in Mansfield Park, were central to her vision of the novel. So definitely something she was thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah, she wouldn't put a scene in about reading out loud if she weren't actually thinking about how is my stuff going to be read out loud. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we have some kind of interesting editorial history with Mansfield Park. So some people have read the punctuation in Mansfield Park as an indication of the influence of elocution. So punctuation, in general, in a lot of ways, is really about making sure that sentences sound logical, like literally that they sound right. It's part of elocution and oral reading. So in the 1814 edition of the novel, according to Pinch, quote, the heavy use of commas creates a rhythm of utterance running on and pauses as if Edmund is thinking his way through his position. In 1816, that's the second edition, some of those commas have been replaced with more grammatically correct semicolons. In this version, Edmund's speech reads more like a composed set of sententia. He's guilty of the pomposity and priggishness that indeed some readers have accused him of. But yeah, like the way that you would say this, you know, if it sounds like he's kind of like pausing and thinking through the idea, that's very, very normal. Whereas if it's more like, I have stated ideas and I am going to orate on them.
I practiced this in front of the mirror and now I am ready yes. to speechify. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that sets a completely different tone.
At any rate, the discussion between Edmund and Crawford sets up a clear context for the debates around elocution. And that, in turn, makes it easier for us to examine Fanny's reactions to Crawford's most excellent reading.
Yes, I mean, let's get into this, right? So we've established now that oral reading was a legitimate pastime in drawing rooms as a social activity. Amit Yahav explains in the article Austin's Literary Time that this scene, quote, realistically recreates a common activity of 18th century domestic leisure, which often functioned as an occasion to display cultural capital.
And we see that as the scene plays out. Before Crawford enters the room, Fanny was the one reading to Lady Bertram. And while Crawford is reading, Fanny compares the experience to hearing Sir Thomas or Edmund and her other cousins reading. This establishes a pattern of reading aloud in the setting and the particular emphasis on good reading as Fanny perceives it.
We also better understand, as Pinch describes it, that, quote, Austin wrote her novels in an era that glamorized the presence and capacities of the human voice. Henry's reading serves as a kind of siren's call to Fanny. So vivid is it that she cannot resist becoming entranced. Whew. Yeah.
It's, She is on that ship and she is mesmerized.
100%.
And that quote brings us quite neatly to this next moment. At the top of the episode, we read the passage that emphasizes Crawford's abilities as a reader. So now we need to read Austin's description of how the reading is impacting Fanny. And this is from Edmund's perspective. Edmund watched the progress of her attention and was amused and gratified by seeing how she gradually slackened in the needlework, which at the beginning seemed to occupy her totally, how it fell from her hand while she sat motionless over it, and at last, how the eyes which had appeared so studiously to avoid him throughout the day were turned and fixed on Crawford. Fixed on him for minutes, fixed on him, in short, till the attraction drew Crawford's upon her, and the book was closed, and the charm was broken.
There is something about those last lines that just really emphasizes how intently she is listening to Crawford. That repetition of fixed three times drives home the fact that Fanny is entirely drawn in. She is giving him her entire focus for once in this novel. And it's both a mental and physical focus.
Well, there's something about even the use of the word slackened, right? That is describing how she isn't paying attention to her needlework. But you can also sort of imagine her slack-jawed.
Yes. Yeah.
She's just like sitting there like mouth open. Her hands are no longer occupied. She can't pay attention to anything else. Like she is wholly fixated on what Crawford is doing in this moment.
And like truly no other time in the novel does he have this from her.
So Henry really is a siren here. You know, he has seduced Fanny with his voice. As Peter Graham puts it in his article, Falling for the Crawfords, Henry's reading, quote, produces heat.
Yes.
Okay.
Basically, Crawford is hot. His reading of Shakespeare is a rare instance where Fanny is just like, she's drawn to him rather than like being shoved toward him by all these family members. In Elizabeth Newark's article, Words Not Spoken, Courtship and Seduction in Jane Austen's Novels, she points out the contrast between Fanny's reaction to Crawford's direct declarations and then of his reading of Shakespeare. So here's how she describes it. Henry makes inroads when he is instrumental in effecting William Price's promotion, and when he reads from Shakespeare with great dramatic ability, and when he meets Fanny in Portsmouth and deals with her distressing family with tact and good manners. Like when he's actually being maybe a genuine human being, that's when she can make connection with him. And so him being like, oh, this is something that I'm good at, reading out loud, that's when she's like, oh, hey, that is attractive.
These are also all areas where Edmund is clearly inferior when compared to Henry. Edmund is not obtaining promotions for Fanny's beloved brother, and apparently his reading can't hold a candle to Henry's. But Henry ruins the moment by closing the book when he realizes he has captured Fanny's attention. Again, as Austen says, the charm was broken.
Yeah. And you almost wonder, like, what if he just kept going? What if he just really kept going, you know?
Just read the entire play, Henry. Come on.
Yes. Yes. But it's obvious to both Henry and Edmund that Fanny was very much affected during this reading. And even though they both feel that praise cannot be, quote, extorted from her, there's a clear sense that, quote, her praise had been given in her attention. That must content them. Like they're both, like everyone in the room knows what just happened. Well, not Lady Bertram. She never knows what's going on in the room.
Well, and hilariously enough, Henry takes Lady Bertram's praise as a huge sign of his success. So this is from the text. Crawford was excessively pleased. If Lady Bertram, with all her incompetency and languor, could feel this, the inference of what her niece, alive and enlightened as she was, must feel, was elevating. The fact that even Lady Bertram's like, wow, that was very good. He's like, okay, well, if you noticed, I know that Fanny, even though she's not saying anything, is really into this.
Yes.
Crawford is in no way oblivious to his skill set. You know, he knows what he is good at.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. And so it's kind of a funny moment, right? When we get a strong impression of Crawford as this incredibly talented reader. His readings are truly dramatic. You know, again, that's coming from the text. And these snippets of literature have truly come to life. Crawford could be a wildly successful audiobook narrator today.
Yeah. He would have a great contract with Audible, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And people would like log into his like Instagram or TikTok just to hear him read snippets and just be like, man, that is compelling.
What a voice. What a voice. The skills needed to be someone who could read aloud really well absolutely transcends 200 years. According to Pinch, literary historians and theorists influenced by media studies and sound studies have asked us to think about the novel as part of the long history of voice reproduction technologies. In this view, audiobooks are the fulfillment of the two centuries long dream. Yeah, like back then you didn't have Audible, but it's fine because you had Henry Crawford in your drawing room reading you Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
What could be better?
And it was a moment, you know, if you could get a Henry Crawford in your drawing room.
Now your iPhone with your Audible app is it's pocket Henry Crawford. That's what you have.
It's so true. But I think we all know of voices that we can like think of in our own brain where it's like, I would listen to that person read any book.
Yeah. Crawford is really giving like, I could read the dictionary and you will be entranced kind of energy.
Yeah. He's giving, you know, Richard Armitage, you know, those kinds of voices.
Okay, well, all right.
Have I sold you on this idea yet? I mean, really. So now we need to talk about how this kind of shows up in the adaptations and kind of other situations. My favorite depiction of this in adaptations is from the 1999 film. And Crawford reads, actually, instead of reading from Shakespeare, he's reading from Lawrence Stern's Sentimental Journey. And this is an absolute moment on screen for Fanny and Crawford, especially, I think, because it happens in private. Like, they're both sitting in a library, and he comes and asks her if he can read. And she does it. And, like, there's, like, they are both, like, making eye contact and having this kind of very intense moment. And I think what makes it also kind of so powerful is that we also see through the door, Mariah has seen these two having this interaction. And you can see that she's kind of like crushed. You can see that she's like, oh, he's never read to me. And so in the very next scene, she actually is going to her father and pushing for her marriage to Rushworth.
It also doesn't hurt that in this adaptation, it's Alessandra Nivola who's reading out loud. So
I mean, okay. Like we need to acknowledge that. Yes.
I mean, he really brings it in the scene. Like he brings it.
Yes. And they chose a beautiful passage, a meaningful passage also for the novel, right?
Yeah. So this choice of a sentimental journey in this adaptation is also a direct tie-in to the novel. In the ha-ha scene in Mansfield Park, Mariah references this same passage when waiting for Rushworth to return with the key. She says, "But unluckily that iron gate, that ha-ha, give me a feeling of restraint and hardship. I cannot get out, as the starling said." So having Henry Crawford read the scene to Fanny is definitely a little Easter egg for people familiar with the novel.
Mm-hmm. And it's his reading of it is truly, it is beautiful. It is a beautiful reading of it.
Again, Alessandra Nivola. Wow.
Lest we forget, you know, exclamation mark. Going to circle back to that. Yes. This reading scene also shows up briefly in the 2007 adaptation of Mansfield Park. But Crawford reads a passage from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. And the scene tends to be really emphasizing the exchange between Fanny and Crawford, mostly about this idea of constancy. It's not really about the reading. It's about the exchange that happens after the reading, which, again, is in the novel. Where Crawford says something like, maybe I'm not the most constant. Fanny's like, I noticed.
Apparently nobody wants to have Henry Crawford read from Henry VIII. So they're like, okay, what else can we pull in that sort of still fits? You know?
Yeah.
Well, and that being said, we do have to mention the 1983 adaptation of Mansfield Park that does a version quite faithful to the text with Henry Crawford actually reading a speech from Henry VIII and showing Fanny definitely being impressed with his reading. So not all the adaptations alter the text that Henry is reading in this scene.
Yeah, but it's always kind of like the scene is always trying to do something to kind of forward that relationship between the two.
We also know that reading aloud was a popular pastime in Austen's own family. In fact, her brother Henry, lots of Henrys around here, you know? It's like when you're talking about Sense and Sensibility and everyone's named John.
Yes.
So her brother Henry was known for reading aloud from Shakespeare. As Claire Tomlin describes in her book, Jane Austen, A Life, when visiting Godmersham Park, the home of Jane's brother Edward, Henry Austen, quote, knew how to make himself part of the household and was popular with the children, handing out sixpences and joining in their games. He would come in winter for the festivities, attend the Canterbury and Ashford balls, and make up parties for the theater with dinner at the Fountain Inn. And he read Shakespeare aloud to anyone who would listen in the evenings.
I kind of love that. Yeah. I love that.
He's the kind of guy you want to have around, you know?
Like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and like having a really talented reader read to you in the evenings. I mean, like, yes, invite that dude to all the parties. Yeah.
Again, no television, no radio. Like this is your option.
Yes. Yes. Having audible live performances. Yes.
There is no Spotify app. You don't have that.
Yes. And Tomlin also later points out that in regards to Mansfield Park specifically, quote, "The Shakespearean comparison comes readily to mind because, of all Austen's books, Mansfield Park shows most traces of Shakespeare. Eliza and Henry, to whom Jane was close during the period in which she planned the book, were keen theatergoers and knew their Shakespeare and, as we have seen, he enjoyed reading aloud, exactly as Henry Crawford does." So it comes full circle. There's definitely a connection point.
It's all coming back around. Well, if you have any thoughts on the scene, reading aloud, Henry Crawford reading aloud, all of that.
His siren song.
His siren song. If you have a similar reaction to Fanny's, let us know. You can find us via our website, thethingaboutaustin.com, and you can always email us at thethingaboutaustin@gmail.com. And you can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Austin_things, and via our Instagram at thethingaboutaustin. And you can also check out our merch for the podcast on Redbubble, which you can find at aboutaustin.redbubble.com.
And we will have some new merch options coming soon. So again, stay tuned. And then also, as ever, stay tuned for next episode, where we'll be talking about Captain Wentworth's letter with our guest, Margaret H. Willison.
Thank you for listening. Bye.